is of PI and Xinhuan Chen for inviting me to come here. So actually, we are going to talk and present some aspects of Hurava Lipsis cosmology. So the goal of the talk is to describe cosmological scenarios in a universe governed by Hurava Lipsis gravity. However, let me mention that from the start, that a consistent, a good cosmology is not a proof for the underlying gravitational theory. Actually, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. It doesn't tell you anything about the underlying gravitational theory. So you need that. However, if you want to study, if your underlying gravitational theory is valid, is robust, then it has to fulfill its own theoretical and experimental requirements. So the talk is going to be on Hurava-Lipsis cosmology, and only in the end we will discuss some things about the gravitational theory itself. So the plan of the talk will be the following. First, we're going to present Hurava-Lipsis gravity and apply that to cosmological frameworks. Then we are interested in investigating late-time solutions, that is, solutions that do not depend on the specific evolution of the universe. So this is a key point in every cosmological scenario. After that, we are going to discuss bouncing and cyclic solutions in this framework. You know, bouncing and cyclic solutions are quite interesting because they solve, or actually they elevate, the singularity problems of the conventional cosmology. After that, we are going to use observations in order to constrain the parameters of the model. This is actually this is something always done in cosmology. Then we are going to discuss some thermodynamical aspects, and in the end, we are going to refer to the problems of Hurava gravity itself. Okay, so let me start by saying that Hurava-Lipsis gravity is a power counting, renormalizable theory of gravity. It possesses an infrared fixed point, namely general relativity. However, in the ultraviolet, it has a good behavior with an anisotropic scale between space in time. So the idea is that if you break Lorentz invariant, so your theory does not respect the full diffeomorphism of GR, then your gravitational constant becomes dimensionless, so you don't have the renormalizability problems that you have in conventional approaches to quantum gravity. So this is the idea, the key idea. We will see, I don't know, I mean, nobody knows if it will work in the end, but it's quite interesting, a different approach to quantum gravity. So, it was actually first invented by Hurava almost 2.5 years ago, and by that time there are a large amount of papers in the literature, but still it is an open subject. I mean, there are many conceptual and theoretical problems. So, people still discuss on that. So, let me very briefly give you the details of Hurava gravity. So, Since there is no isotropy between scale and time, it's very convenient to work in the so-called ADM formalism. That is, we have a foliation preserving diffeomorphism. So we start with an action of this form. So here the dynamical variables are the laps and the shift functions and the spatial metric GIJ. This is the form of the anisotropic scaling in the ultraviolet. And now we have to write an action. In principle, an axion consistent with this framework may contain many, many terms. However, Hurava himself, in his initial works, he used the so-called Dittell balance condition. This is a term borrowed from condensed matter physics. So he used this condition in order to restrict the number of terms in the axion. So, I mean, this is the basic, simplest scenario of Hurava gravity. So we have these terms here, Kij, I don't know, can you see that clearly? Anyway, Kij is the extrinsic curvature and Cij is the quantum tensor. So here we have parameters, mu, w, kappa. We have the capital lambda, which plays the role of a cosmological constant. And Korableff's gravity has an additional parameter, which is this small lambda here, which is the parameter that determines the flow between the infrared and the ultraviolet. So when this small lambda is equal to 1, our theory gives us general relativity. So we do get GR in the infrared, and in the ultraviolet, we still have this well-behaved behavior. So this is the basic scenario of Kurava gravity. If we want to do cosmology with that is apply that to a universe. What do you mean, the detailed bounce condition?
Yeah.
No, actually, okay, just, I would tell, it's just quite arbitrary. So in the end, I will show you this, it doesn't work. But actually, it's just an assumption how to reduce the numbers in the action. Yeah, I agree with you that this is quite arbitrary. I mean, he borrowed this term from condensed matter, but anyway, it doesn't work.
But can you explain in what sense that action satisfied the balance?
Okay, so let me say that differently. Here, as I showed you in the end, you could have many, many more terms. So the detailed balance, first of all, gives you only this term, and the detailed balance condition actually correlates your coefficient. So you can see that, for example, the coefficient of this term depends on that. Or you can see here you have mu, and here you have also mu. I mean, in principle, there is no reason why this coefficient should be correlated like that. So the detailed balance condition makes you two things. First, it reduces the number of terms in the action. And secondly, it correlates with the coefficients. I mean, in the end, that I will go beyond the detailed balance and beyond some other assumptions, I will give you the general action. So in the end, you will see the difference.
That's some symmetry.
It's quite a bitter. This is it.
So there's a particular form that this comes from. It's like a square of some generative function, and then you write a motion at the generative function, but then you have to square that.
Yeah, that was the in his logic. Yeah, but okay, doesn't work. So good. So as I told you, I will focus on cosmology. And then in the end, we're going back to gravity. So if you want to do cosmology now in such a framework, you have to do two things. First, choose your cosmological buffer. So we assume an FRW metric, and actually Korableff himself and many, many other authors, they assume projectability. That is, they assume that the lapse function here depends only on time, so it can be set to 1. The second thing that you have to do is to add matter in your scenario. So there are two ways to add matter in Korableff's gravity. The first is to use scalar field and attribute the dark matter content to that scalar field. Actually, this is theoretically robust approach. However, for phenomenology and phenomenological works, it's not so convenient, because then you have to have a very peculiar potential in order to have a constant zero dark matter equation of state parameter. So it's theoretically robust, because you define an action in terms of scalar field, but for phenomenological works, it's not so convenient. The second approach to add matter in this scenario is to use the hydrodynamical approach. However, it's not so simple in terms of the underlying, the fundamental level. However, you can still do that by adding, for example, rho m and pm straight away in the gravitational equations of motion, and demand to get the gr in the infrared. So we will follow both ways. So in this case, if you derive the Friedmann equation for the simplest version of Korableff's gravity, that is under detailed balance, you get these two Friedmann equations. So we have the curvature terms here. We have matter here, we have a constant term that plays the role of the cosmological constant, and the new ingredient of Kurava gravity, even at this simplest version, is that we get a term behaving like the radiation. This is the so-called dark radiation term. It appears in brainwave models, and I mean, it's quite usual. So we do get that in Kurava gravity. And of course, matter satisfy the standard conservation equation. So these are the Friedmann equation. Now, if we observe their form, then what we could say about their coincidence to the standard Friedmann equation, first of all, you have to perform this identification of the parameters. So in the standard Friedmann equation, this coefficient is 1. So you just set that to 1. The second thing is that this is the coefficient here should be the Newton's constant. So you use this identification. However, let me just make a small comment here. In theories where Lorentz invariant is broken, like parabolic gravity, the cosmological Newton's constant, that is the Newton's constant that is read from the Friedmann equation, does not coincide with the gravitational Newton's constant, that is the Newton's constant that is read from the action. We knew that, I mean, back from the 30s. So this here is the cosmological Newton's constant. However, in the infrared, when we take GR, that is Lorentz invariance is restored, these two definitions coincide. So, and what remains is that we can absorb all these extra terms that are not present in standard Friedmann equations to an effective dark energy sector. So now, Horava Lipschitz cosmology coincides completely with standard cosmology. However, we have got an effective dark energy sector, which has, of course, interesting phenomenology. And of course, it obeys the standard conservation equation. And now, if you want to go beyond detail balance, I don't give you the action right now, I will give it you in the end. But anyway, so in this case, we have extra terms. You see now the coefficients of the parameters of the theory as these sigmas. They are uncorrelated, you see, so in the action you have different coefficients. And the new ingredient is that we get a term proportional to a to the minus 6. So skipping the details, beyond detail balance, the Friedmann equations take this form. Again, I make these identifications, and in this case, the dark energy sector, the effective dark energy sector, is defined through these two equations. So you can see that the structure of the theory is even richer right now.
The k is the curvature?
Yes, the small k.
So it's like plus or minus 1?
Yes, exactly. So just since you mentioned that, you immediately you can see from here that if we have a flat universe, then Horava gravity coincides completely with GI. You see all these terms get zero, and you just get the standard Friedmann equation. So in order to see the new effects, you have to have a non-flat universe, and people know that. So until now, we have reviewed briefly Horava Lipschitz gravity, and we have applied that, its simplest version, to Horava Lipschitz cosmology. So let us investigate the cosmology in a universe governed by Horava Lipschitz gravity. The first thing that people do in such cases is to look for late time stable solutions. That is, for solutions that are independent of the specific initial conditions. That is, solutions that are independent of the specific evolution of the universe. Actually, this is a key point in every cosmological scenario, because in the end of the day, we want our model to be able to predict a universe like the one we observe today, but without tuning. So you need to have late-time solutions that will attract your universe independently of the history. Otherwise, your cosmological scenario will be quite tuned. So the standard approach is to transform your system to an autonomous dynamical system, to its autonomous form. So you introduce dimensionless variables, and in terms of these variables, you define the density parameters and the equation of state parameters. So you transform your full system of equations of motion into this form. So this is the vector of these four variables. Prime is derivative in terms of log a, the logarithm of the scale factor. So what is the standard approach is, first, you look for the critical points of the system, and they are given by this condition. And then, for each critical point, you linearize your system around it. So U is the column of the perturbation you perform, and the idea is that you result for each critical point, you result in this matrix equation. So by studying the eigenvalues of the matrix Q, you can determine the type and the stability of the critical point. So if the eigenvalues are all negative, your critical point is stable. If they are positive, it's unstable. And if they change sign, it's a saddle point. So these are the basics of space-space analysis. So we applied that in Horava-Lipschitz gravity. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, in the beginning, we don't know what kind of solutions they are, but we want them to be stationary. And especially, we want them to be stable stationary solutions.
What would be stationary in terms of one set of variables would not be...
You see, the mathematics would be different, but your point, it's the same. It's independent of your variable choice. So the logic is that you define these variables, so you can define them whatever you want. Actually, this choice is standard in the literature, the first two. Then you solve this equation, so you find that at my critical point, xc takes this value, yc takes the other value, and all this stuff. So at this critical point, I'm going and calculate what is the value of dark energy density parameter and matter density parameter. So this is independent of your variable. You will always find the same physical observables, which are given by this expression. And of course, the stability analysis is going to be the same. The eigenvalues weren't going to be the same for different choice. But if the point is stable or unstable, actually it will be the same independently of the variables.
So the fixed points are static universes.
In principle, the fixed point are static. However, they can be unstable or stable, right? So I mean, For example, if you have a potential like that and you have your system there, if you put it exactly there, it is a static solution. But this is unstable. So it means that perturbations will. So this is this is exactly what we are doing here, but in many dimensions. So for detailed balance case, you can see that for zero cosmological constant, just an example, and non-zero curvature, we have a stable point. This is this P3. However, it corresponds to dark matter domination. An expanding universe completely dominated by dark matter, so this is not so interesting. So in the other case, we don't obtain a stable point. This is saddle point, again corresponding to dark matter domination. So these are not so interesting. Yeah?
So you said you're trying to find a critical point which is a steady universe, but we know today what we observe is not steady.
Actually, it's stationary.
State.
So this is the idea that all the, the dark matter, density parameter, dark energy, all of this will have a constant value. If you are asking, okay, actually what is the question? Is the following. Okay, I agree with that. So this has to do with the late time solutions. However, how do I know that the current universe is in a late time solution? And the answer is that we don't know that. There are two schools. Some authors believe that we are in a late time solution because it's quite a long history. Some others believe that still not a late time. So we are still in the
Indian.
Well,
obviously, we're not in late time because dark energy is just
down. I agree. Yes, I agree. Totally agree. And that is why this is a so called coincidence problem of cosmology. So, why dark energy and dark matter are of the same order? And you can, not in Horava gravity, but in other cosmological scenarios, the solution is to add interactions between dark matter and dark energy. So in that case, in the late time solution, you could get omega dark energy equals to 0.7 as expected. So.
So what is this x and u value again? Can you show me again this x and u value?
Ah, x and z. So these are the definitions.
So what is phi?
Sorry, what is?
What is phi? What is the pure phi?
Phi is the it's the matter field actually. You see? Yeah, yeah. I told you that in Kurama gravity you have two ways to add matter. The first is to use a scalar field responsible for matter. And the other is to use a hydrodynamical description. So in this case, phi is just, it's responsible for matter. Yeah, it's just an approach. I mean, you can follow the other approach also. So
what does z equal to 0 mean there? Because if z equal to 0, that means either h is infinite or...
No, because, because it means that it's an internally expanding universe. That is why. So a is going to infinity. I mean, you can go, the phase space analysis is quite well used in cosmology. I can show you the paper. So all these are standard behaviors. So this is the behavior of detailed balance. So it's not quite interesting. So if we repeat everything beyond the detailed balance condition, then we do the same thing. And in this case, we find the stable late time solution completely dominated by dark energy, where the dark energy behaves like a cosmological constant. So this is actually a good solution, consistent, with observations.
But now you don't have matter anymore. Your all four x are from the gravity.
Here?
Yeah, sigma 1.
No, okay, you have it, but it does not appear in this. If you look at the paper, you can see the details. Yeah, I skip the details now because it's a multidimensional system, so it's quite difficult. But the result is like that. However, you do get with a small probability, you get an oscillatory solution. So there is a small probability that your universe results in a cyclic condition. That is, you have a bounce and a turnaround all the time. So these terms, remember, we have these new terms in Friedmann equations. They are responsible for the bounce because they are huge at small scale factors, and the cosmological constant, it will give you the turnaround. So let us now investigate these bounce solutions in detail. So what is a bounce and a turnaround in general? So for a bounce, you need to have a contracting phase. So the Hubble parameter is negative. It becomes zero exactly at the bounce, and then it becomes positive. And throughout this procedure, the H dot, it's positive. On the other hand, what is a turnaround? You have an expanding phase. So H is positive, it's zero on the turnaround, and then in the contracting phase, it becomes negative. And throughout all this procedure, H dot is negative. So these are the general requirements of the bounce. So the question is, can we obtain this in Kurama lift gravity? And the answer is, if we observe the form of the two equations, of the two Friedmann equations, in the beyond detailed balance case, you can easily see that if we play here with the parameters, we can obtain these requirements. So in principle, we can obtain a bounce and cyclic behavior. So let me investigate that in detail. Actually, we have two ways of thinking that. The first is, choose your matter potential, your matter scalar field, and investigate for which subset of the parameter space, that is, for which values of the parameters, you obtain cyclic solutions. However, the second point of view is to require cyclicity for all the parameter choice, but you have to reconstruct sufficiently your matter potential. So we will follow the second case. So the idea is, assume an oscillatory scale factor, impose a scale factor by hand. Then you can use your equations of motions and reconstruct the scalar field for matter and its potential. So you reconstruct the matter potential that is responsible for this oscillatory scale factor. So in practice, if you start just for a toy model and you plug in this oscillatory scale factor, you can see this is the scale factor evolution NH. So here you do get, the requirements of a bounce. H is positive, negative, etc. So the output is this potential for matter. So you see, this is oscillatory because we're expecting that an oscillatory potential to be able to reproduce an oscillatory scale factor. So the answer is that this potential will reproduce this oscillatory unit. So this is not complete, it's not a science potential. You see here it's different than here, but it gives us the idea. So let us follow now the bottom-to-top approach and do the opposite. Plug in this oscillatory potential and the output is an oscillatory universe. So indeed, Kurava lattice gravity allows for bouncing and a cyclic solution, which is quite interesting. And of course, the important thing is to see the processing of perturbations through the bounds. And this was done by...
So are these attractor solutions?
What?
Are these attractor?
Yeah, exactly. And first of all, we reveal that through the phase space analysis, and then we explore them in detail. Good. So this is another qualitative feature of Kurava lattice cosmology. Let me now go to the dark energy sector. As I said in the beginning, in Kurava lattice cosmology, you define an effective dark energy sector. However, the way we define that, it's a question of state parameter is always in the quintessence regime. So it's always larger than minus one. However, as you know, there are indications today that the equation of state parameter of dark energy could be smaller than minus one, that is, in the phantom regime. So the question is...
Sorry, we don't know that.
Yeah, that's why I put indications. Yeah, we don't know that. Probably it's not the case. But there are indications. I mean, concerning
that. That is the bottom indications that are below.
Yeah. No, if you ask me, I will tell you in the end, I believe in the cosmological constant. So I guess lambda CDM is the best model for me. But anyway, let's see if Kurava lattice gravity can describe this phase. And the answer is yes, if I add a scalar field responsible for the dark energy sector. So I add the canonical scalar field. So this will be added in my previously defined effective dark energy sector. So, in the beginning I have only these terms here, so now I add this scalar field. And obviously you can see now, this expression, you observe that the dark energy equation of state parameter can be larger than minus one, that is in the quintessence regime, it can be smaller than minus one, that is in the phantom regime, or it can experience the phantom divide crossing during the evolution. The important point here is that this field is canonical. You see, in conventional cosmology, if you want to describe the so-called phantom phase, you introduce phantom fields, that is with a negative kinetic term here, which are obviously unstable at the quantum level. However, here you can obtain that with a canonical scale. And just for completeness, I'm telling you that there could be an alternative way. So instead of a scalar field, you can go to F of R for Kurava lattice cosmology, as Nazir and Zhitsov made. So the case is like conventional cosmology. In conventional cosmology, you want to describe a phantom space. Either you introduce a phantom field, or you go to F of R cosmology. So here, the case is the same. However, we have an advantage now that this is always positive.
But the problem is k is 1 to 0, so those terms already...
Yes, this is a disadvantage of the whole for our graph, because for k equals 0, it coincides completely with gr.
So given the fact that we don't, those terms, the sigma 3 and sigma 4 cannot be used because there will be no gravity.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
K is very close to 0, then, I mean...
So, you mean in practice, I mean, you'll see in the end. Yes, Kurava gravity needs a tuning in the coefficient, but this is just the qualitative feature. So, since we have explored a bit the solutions that are possible in Kurava gravity, let us now use observations in order to constrain the parameters of the model. So, we will use observations from supernova, baryon acoustic oscillations, CMB, and arguments from Big Bang nucleosynthesis in order to constrain the parameters of the theory. So, in this case, I will add matter and radiation hydrodynamically. So there's no scalar field now. So because for phenomenological works this is better. So I assume straight away that matter and radiation behaves like that. I will use the redshift as the independent variable. And a key point here is that, as I told you, in Kurama gravity we have this small lambda determining the flow between the infrared and the ultraviolet. However, cosmological observations are always in the deep infrared. So I will fix that one. I will come back to that later on. And of course, we set our units. So the standard procedure is, first of all, you write your Friedmann equation like that. So we introduce the Hubble parameter at present, and these are the density parameters are present. This is the standard approach, and we have this dimensionless variable. So we have four parameters to be confronted by the data. However, we have two constraints. The first is that we have the Friedmann equation at present. So it gives us a relation between the parameters. Now, the second constraint comes from arguments of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So, at the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, so at redshift around a billion, the total amount of radiation that was present is constrained. So, actually, the extra amount of radiation is quantified through this effect of neutrino species, and this is bounded in these limits. As I told you in the beginning, in Kurama gravity, we have a dark radiation term proportional to a to the minus 4. So this term is constrained by Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So we do get a relation like that. So in the end, we have four variables to be confronted by the data with two constraints. So we have only two free variables. And the results are these. In the detailed balance case, we can draw the contour plots for these variables. And at one sigma confidence level, we can see that we get this bound for the parameters. So this is the constraint of the parameters for the detailed balance case. We can go and do the same things beyond detailed balance. So, in this case,
what is the curvature that you get, the best curvature in?
Yeah, previously? Yeah, we have actually, it's like that. So, for two cases, for positive and negative, we get these limits. Yeah, it's quite small, as you say.
Is this the point that, like, if you go on a scale, the scale of transition from general relativity to this Kurama gravity is the Hubble scale today? So,
yeah.
If any scale is smaller than Hubble, you don't have
generative
anymore.
No, but you see, in the infrared, because we fixed lambda equals to n, your theory is GR, but we have this extra dark radiation term. So, you have just one extra term.
And the reason you have that is because those higher curvature terms are important.
Yeah, but these are not, okay, these are have been integrated out. So, you just have this term in order to
fit
that.
It's integrated out. For cosmology, but for any other test of gravity, those terms are there.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Modify the test of gravity. So
I totally agree. I will come to that in the end. So there is, I mean, your question is, what will be, for example, the solar system, the PPN parameter analysis for this theory, or in the experiments? I agree. I tell you that there is no answer to that, but I will discuss it in the end.
No, but I think you're missing my point is that these terms are introduced to fix the problem of quantum gravity. So they are supposed to kick in around Planck scale. I mean, okay, so maybe it's about the scale or something like that.
Yes.
So if they're going to affect cosmology today, then they are much, much bigger than the purpose, basically, than what they were used for.
Okay, so the answer is the following. So in Kurama gravity, you put extra terms in order to obtain a good, okay, not quantum behavior, but anyway, a good ultraviolet behavior. However, if you go to the infrared, of course, all these terms disappears, you have Lorentz value, but you still get some new terms that I agree, this should be really very, very small. And actually this, yeah, you can see that here, that these are really, really small. You see, the idea is like, go take f of r, for example. f of r is the low energy limit of a higher, I don't know, higher dimensional of an underlying fundamental theory. But still, at the classical level, you have f of r. You don't have completely gr. However, the extra f of r information has to be small.
But there isn't, f of r is not a theory of quantum gravity. This is
no, no. Theory. Yes, exactly. The actually, f of r, you assume it to be the low energy limit of an unknown fundamental theory. But in f of r, you do get, I mean, a classical result. However, still, it's not gr. I mean, you get extra terms, which are small, I agree. I mean, so if you go now beyond the detailed balance, so you repeat everything, now we have these parameters to be confronted by the data. Again, we have two constraints, the Friedman equation at present and the Big Bang nucleosynthesis constraints in the parameters. So again, we have two free parameters for a given value of the effective neutrino species. So, and these are the results of the observational constraint on the model parameters. For example, you can see that the coefficients of the 8 to the 6th term is very, very small. You see, so they disappear. So at one sigma confidence level, this is the story. So let me go on. And as I told you initially, since observations lie deep inside the infrared, we fixed the small lambda to 1, that is the value determining the flow between the ultraviolet and the infrared, we fixed it to 1. However, one could ask, just let it vary and leave our observations to tell us what are the limits on lambda. So what we're doing next, it's we allow lambda to vary too. So we perform an overall observational fitting, allow everything to vary and lambda also. So again, we repeat the procedure, the standard procedure, and our result was this. So in the detailed balance case, lambda is restricted to this narrow window. Beyond the detailed balance, lambda is restricted to this narrow window. However, the best value is much, much closer to 1. So this was expected, because we know that in the real world, where we lie in the ether, the flow parameter of our gravity should be close to 1. However, we did verify that in that paper. So indeed, lambda is inside a very, very narrow window around this infrared value. Note that this was an overall approach to the problem. Because, for example, there are papers in the literature trying to constrain the small lambda using phenomenological arguments. For example, as I told you in the beginning, if you are away from the infrared, then your gravitational Newton's constant and your cosmological Newton's constant diverge. However, this divergence is constrained by the abundance of primordial helium 4. So people use that. So they use the difference between the two Gs to constrain lambda. But in this way, because we perform an overall fitting, we get one order of magnitude smaller bounds. Good. This, what you see, the projectability condition. No, this is all projectable. I will show you in the end, I will tell you how to go to non-projectables. So, let me just describe some thermodynamical aspects now. As you know, there is a deep connection in physics between gravity and thermodynamics. So, you can always write your field equations in any gravitational theory as a first law of thermodynamics. Not, however, the opposite is not always true. And this doesn't mean that your theory is not good. So, what you are doing is the following. You consider the universe to be a thermodynamical system. So first, you need to define its radius, its volume. It has to be closed. So what people do is to take the apparent horizon as the horizon of the universe. So after that, you define the entropy and the energy and the pressure of the universe interior, of the fluids that exist inside the universe. And, of course, you have to define the entropy and the temperature of the horizon of the universe. And of course, we assume equilibrium, so the horizon temperature is equal to the interior of the universe temperature. So, what, okay, for the universe interior, we know the result, we can do, I mean, we know the energy, the pressure, and all this stuff. So what is the entropy and the temperature of the horizon? And the answer in the literature is that I use black hole physics result. So if I have a black hole, I know its entropy and its temperature. So the key point in all this discussion, there are hundreds of papers on that, is to take the black hole results and apply them to the universe. But instead of the black hole horizon, we will use the apparent horizon. For example, just to give you a very simple example, suppose we have a general relativity universe with FRW geometry. So in this case, the variation of entropy inside the universe takes this form. What can be said about the horizon? As I told you, I'm going to use the black hole results. So, for entropy and temperature, the temperature relation, according to Hawking, depends only on the geometry. So for spherical solutions, for spherical geometry, this is always given by this form. Now, for the entropy relation, this does depend on the specific gravitational theory. So this is the GR result. So I assume now that the universe has this temperature, like the horizon, that the horizon entropy is this one. You see, instead of a black hole horizon, I'm taking this. And if you put this here and applying the first law of thermodynamics, you get the Friedmann equation. These are known results in the literature. So there is this connection between gravity and thermodynamics. So this was about the first law. And as you know, in the literature, there is the so-called generalized second law of thermodynamics. So what is this? Actually, this tells us that the total entropy time variation, so that means the time variation of the universe fluids and the time variation of the entropy of the horizon, must be non-negative. And people apply that to every gravitational theory. So let us investigate that in Kurava-Lipschitz cosmology. So we assume that we have a universe that contains matter. And so first, let me find out the time, the entropy time variations of the universe interior. So I have this expression. So the volume of the universe is like that here. RA is the apparent horizon. So its energy and pressure are standard. So easily from here, you can get the entropy time variation for the interior of the universe. And the derivative of the apparent horizon is easily obtained through a differentiation of the Friedmann equation. So, in summary, for the interior of the universe, I have this entropy time variation. So what can be said now about the horizon? Because I need to find the entropy time variation of the horizon. As I told you, I will use the black hole result. So I need two things, temperature and entropy. For the temperature of the horizon, I will use this formula, because as I told you, this formula does not depend on the gravitational sector. It depends only on the geometry. So since I have spherical geometry, this is always valid. Now, for the entropy of the horizon, I need the black hole result. However, this result does depend on the specific gravitational theory. So I have to find black hole solutions in Kurava gravity, and there are many, many papers in the literature on this subject. So for detailed balance case, you get the solution of this form. So you have the GR result plus a correction here. So I use this for the entropy of the horizon, and then its time variation is given by this formula. So if I assemble everything together, I'm taking this result. So for a closed universe, this is always positive. And for a flat universe. However, for an open universe, it's not. So the generalized second law of thermodynamics is conditionally violated in Kurava-Lipschitz gravity. So what can we say about that? Actually, the first thing one could say is to put into question GSL itself. You see, it's a conjecture, it's not a law by Bekenstein. I mean, it's not proven. But anyway, let's leave that aside. So the first point is that, does our result depend on the horizon? So if instead of the apparent horizon, we use the Hubble horizon or the future event horizon, so yes, the result will be the same. GSL is not valid. And if I go beyond detail balance, then it's even worse, because the correction term has no, does not have a constant sign, so again, it's violated.
So, isn't this whole discussion about horizons kind of pointless, because you don't really, your graph must propagate faster than the speed of light. So, if you don't really have
Very good. That's exactly very good. And actually, this is here, because there are people claiming that your theory is not relativistic. So perhaps this discussion is useless, because you cannot define horizons. You cannot define temperature, you cannot define entropy. So, I mean, if you go to that, that another paper, so there are people saying you cannot play with these things for our graph. So these are all answers. Or, of course, this is another sign, probably, that something goes wrong with our graph. So let me just, before reaching the end, that's okay, I added this slide for fun and more. You know, obviously, I mean, you've heard the OPERA results about supernuminal neutrinos in CERN. So let me just play a little bit with Hoare gravity and see if this is possible here. Obviously, I mean, my personal opinion is that they are doing a systematical error in OPERA, so they will find it out later on. But just for the moment, let me just show you this. So the idea is, investigate the neutrinos' motion in Earth gravitational field. So we will assume that the Earth gravitational field, we will take it to be we will take the black hole spherical solution. So as you know, this is the spherical solution, and in Hoare gravity, this is a quite common spherical solution, a black hole solution. So we will apply that for being the gravitational field of Earth. So this has the correct GR limit, and I mean, everything is fine with that. And if instead of the metric, I use the Warbrain tetrad, which is in the Chandra space, it takes this simple, this simple form over there. So the idea is the following. We want to investigate the Dirac equation in this gravitational background. So we will take it, I mean, the Dirac equation in curved space-time. So skipping the details, just to show you the key point. So we get an equation of this form. So in the end, you can approximately obtain the speed of the particle by the ratio of these two coefficients. So the speed of the particle depends only, I mean, the speed is exactly the same with FR. So it depends only on the radius. So in the same radius, it will be the same. So if we want the speed of a particle at Earth's radius, more or less, I mean, if the speed of light is 1 here. So if we want this difference to be like that, the parameter epsilon here is that small. Okay, this is just to show you that supernuminal neutrinos are obtained in Hoare-Lefèvre gravity. If you apply that in GR, then here is 1 minus 2gm over r, then f of r is always smaller than 1. So it's 1 for small masses. So this is just, I mean, okay, a toy approximate example on this subject. So let me go on. And before going to the conclusions, let me just say something. Until now, we have talked about Hoare-Lefèvre's cosmology. That is, we applied Hoare gravity to cosmological frameworks. However, as I told you in the beginning, this does not say anything about the validity of the underlying theory. It's a necessary but not sufficient test. So if you don't have a good cosmology, then your theory is wrong. But if you have a good cosmology, it doesn't say that your theory is correct. So is Hoare gravity robust? So in order to see that, let me work now on Hoare gravity itself. We perform perturbations in the gravitational theory. So skipping the details, So we perturb it linearly around that background. So we introduce the usual scalar, vector, and tensor perturbations. So for the vector modes, we assume them to be. Here?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the cosmological one. Of course, you can do that in general. So we assume the vector modes to be transverse and the tensor modes to be transverse and traceless. So we will work with the synchronous gates just for simplification. And if you do the work, I don't know if you can see that, but so for the scalar modes at low momenta, we get this expression. So this is the dispersion relation. And at high momentum, we get this. Now, for the tensor mode, we get this dispersion relation. These results are for the detailed balance case. However, if you go beyond detailed balance, so we use a term of this form, you get this ultraviolet behavior for the scalar modes and this for the tensor mode. So now, if you look at the at all these relations, you can see that there are instabilities, obviously. So, what can we do on that? In the literature, initially, they used the trick so-called analytical continuation. So it means that you rotate in the imaginary plane your variables. But obviously, this does not work here. It's not enough. Apart from the fact that such a procedure puts into question the renormalizability of the theory. I mean, you have a renormalizable theory, and then you play with the parameters that way, so it's not so convenient. But anyway, so this doesn't work. The other choice is to go to zero cosmological constant, but this, in this theory, this gives you a zero light speed. So the basic versions of Poincaré gravity, either with or without the detailed balance condition, is ill, there are instabilities. So what is the way out? The way out is look for healthy extensions of Poincaré lifts gravity. So a quite general, not the most general action could have this form.
Can you go back to that? So I just want to see where the instability comes from.
You see here, for example, in the scalar mode, at low k, this is negative. You see, all this here, it's positive. So omega square is negative. This is one point. Here, for example, if you go here, you get a minus term beyond the detailed balance in the k to the sixth term.
That's just Jeans' instability.
What, sorry?
That's just Jeans' instability, that omega square, because there's no k-dependence.
Yeah, of course. I mean, or if you perform that, then you fix that. However, here in the tensor mode, you see, you cannot fix the k to the sixth term.
So just set theta equal to zero.
Yeah, I mean, there are many solutions. So, actually, what is not clear in Poincaré gravity is the following. This is a detail. Okay, we know the infrared value of this small lambda is one. However, what is the ultraviolet value? And there are four answers in the literature. The first is that it does not exist. The second is, by Mikoyama et al., is that it's infinity. The third is that it's somewhere between one and infinity. And the fourth is that it is one third. So the flow is less than one. So you don't know that, if you don't know if this is positive or negative. But anyway, this, I mean, in this work, we saw that, and other people follow that, the basic version of Poincaré gravity is ill-defined. So that is why you have to go to more complicated versions. So here, if you write an action of this form, then this is the kinetic term. This is the detailed balanced form. You see, I have only some terms. This term goes beyond detailed balance. And as you said, there is a new term now that breaks the projectability condition. So you assume that the lapse function depends on space. So, and this is, actually, if you keep only this term, it's the minimum non-projectable version of Poincaré gravity. So what you must do now is repeat everything we did in this version. So this is the story up to now. If you ask me, I would say that Poincaré lifts gravity is indeed a clever idea about the behavior of gravity at the high, high energy. So the idea is good. So if you break the isotropy between space and time, it can give you a renormalizable theory. But in practice, it doesn't seem to work. I mean, if you need to go to more and more and more complicated theories, so I don't know if this is the solution, strictly speaking. So let me summarize. So we applied Kurava gravity in a cosmological framework, and we analyzed cosmological scenarios in a universe governed by Kurava-Lewis gravity. And we saw that the cosmology itself is interesting. So we first obtained late-time solutions that are independent of the specific universe evolution. So we found an eternally expanding universe completely dominated by dark energy, behaving like a cosmological constant. We also found that our scenario accepts bouncing and cyclic solutions. Then we use observations in order to restrict, to constrain the parameters of the model. And indeed, we saw that the small lambda, the parameter that determines the flow between the infrared and the ultraviolet, is constrained in a very narrow window around its infrared value. Then we saw the generalized second law of thermodynamics, and we saw that this is conditionally valid in Kurava-Lewis gravity. And in the end, performing the perturbation analysis, we saw that the basic versions of Kurava gravity have instabilities. So the next step is to go and search for healthy extension. And this is where the literature is up to now. However, many people believe that the story cannot be saved. I mean, you need more and more and more complicated versions. So, what would be the prospect of this analysis? First, as you said, one should try to calculate the parametrized post-Newtonian parameters for Kurava-Lewis gravity. That means to confront the theory, apart from cosmological observations, to the solar system test. You know, the solar system test puts very, very strict constraints in every gravitational scenario. The second is to construct observationally the minimally extended version that is beyond the projectability conditions. Then you could try to examine the generalized second law in the minimally extended version. And of course, in the end, actually the story is still open because you have to provide clues, evidence, arguments that Kurava gravity is still the underlying theory of gravity, because we didn't know that. Okay, that's it.
Most of you, like you said, was for the projectable version.
Yeah.
Like this is fun, yeah. And I mean, it was kind of obvious from the beginning out of the sick theory because it's having like having an extra component of dark matter as Nakayama has shown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's because you lose low Hamiltonian constraint. And when that component crosses itself and it becomes caustic, then the theory breaks down. So that's, you can never have any static solution.
I agree.
So that was out.
Mm-hmm.
So the non-projectable version, there is no problem with that.
In that point, however, I have a doubt concerning the non-projectable version, which of course is much more better than the previous one. And actually, I mean, what I don't like in these works is the following, that in such a scenario, actually somehow you correlate this coefficient, which is the coefficient that breaks the projectability condition, with lambda, the small lambda. That is the parameter that determines the flow between the infrared and ultraviolet. So if you go to these papers and the comments on these papers, they ask, okay, which is the infrared limit? So the answer is that, I mean, that Blazin Sibiryakov says is that if you want to go to the infrared, you have to simultaneously put this A in lambda to zero. the coefficient here, A2. So, and the question is, why to correlate two, at first, uncorrelated points? The first parameter determines the flow, and the second determines the breaking of the projectability condition.
But this A doesn't have to be there to begin with. So
which one?
The A. Yeah.
Yeah, but if
it can be zero from the beginning and it's never generated.
In principle, I agree. However, if you see there is a paper by Sotiriou and Papazoglou commenting on this paper, and they say that you cannot do that unless you fix lambda at one. Because your theory is not, I mean, I can show you the paper, it's not, I mean, the paper is comment on the health extension for armor gravity. So in that paper, they show that you cannot put A to zero unless you put lambda at one. So this is quite strange, because why this had to be correlated?
I think that's cut wrong. So that's.
I was thinking that in the beginning, but I was expecting for the answer. But they didn't write a paper on that after that. I mean, on this question.
I think we should probably wrap up at this
time. Yeah.
I don't want to take more time. Sorry.